This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. Item one, markets go down, two, gang. Item two, tariffs and trade wars. Item three, Tim, Ben, and Hank, one last time. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Thursday today, March the 22nd. Good as always to have you here, everybody, with the stipulation that correlation is not causation. And just to be consistent here, acknowledging that the stock market is not the economy, although they are related, sometimes stocks are trying to tell you something, and today was one of those times. The action in question was the announcement from the White House today aimed at Chinese trade practices. The reaction was the Dow off 724 points, almost 3%. President Trump, as you know, is going to put new tariffs on Chinese imports. That's the headline of perhaps more consequence, though, although much less discussed, is that the president is also going to limit Chinese investment in some key American industries. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore gets us going with that.
Normally, the president would be thrilled when foreign companies invest in the U.S., but not when it comes to China. Dan Eikenson is with the Cato Institute.
It has been stealing technology. It has been forcing technology transfer.
China's said it wants to become number one in certain high-tech industries. The administration, by preventing Chinese investment in high-tech here, wants to prevent China from extracting that tech and innovation from the U.S.
It can be a blunt tool to block investments in a certain number of sectors. And in that sense, it will be effective.
Nick Consonieri studies China for the Rhodium Group. He says the U.S. has been restricting Chinese investment for several years now. Under the Trump proposal, it'd be restricted further.
But the question is, to what end? You know, Chinese investment into the U.S., and in our estimates, employs something like 140,000 workers in the United States today.
Kent Smetters at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton Business School says limiting foreign money might have another downside.
A lot of President Trump's policies, including his recent tax reform, really rely heavily on foreign investment.
When the government spends money it doesn't have, that money has to come from somewhere, and foreign investment helps fill the gap. So ultimately, limiting investment from China is a balancing act between trying to protect the U.S. economy and trying to grow it. A lot's going to depend on how China responds. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
There's a whole lot we could digest here about stocks and what they are trying to tell us. But as I do believe I have said a time or two on this radio program, when things get a bit wiggy on Wall Street, bonds can be a better indicator. The yield on the benchmark 10-year Treasury note fell today, which means, because bond yields fall when the price of those bonds go up, it means a good chunk of the money coming out of stocks today might have been people buying into the safest investment on the planet, a.k.a. U.S. government debt. Flight to quality is the word you are looking for here. I did a quick video bond explainer, by the way. Check it out on YouTube. We are Marketplace APM there. The rest of Wall Street on this Thursday, we will have all the gory details when we do the numbers. Today brings us the final installment of what we have come to call around here the Big Three, the conversation I had last week with former Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson, former Fed Chair Ben Bernanke, and Tim Geithner, then the president of the New York Fed. all about the financial crisis that really came into focus for a lot of people 10 years ago this month. We started back on Monday with the decision to rescue Bear Stearns.
None of us debated at any length as to whether it would be a big problem if Bear Stearns had failed. We all knew that. So the question is, what should we do about it?
We traced through Lehman Brothers, TARP, and the politics of it. Yesterday, we got to what they didn't do.
Trying to help people understand, against their instincts, that, you know, allowing the banking system to collapse was not going to be something that would be irrelevant to their lives, that it was going to have an effect on jobs, on mortgages, on incomes in a really big way.
And now today, the crises yet to come. We start with Tim Geithner and what 2008 taught him about this economy.
I think the big effect it had on me, which is the obvious thing, which is just made me much more worried about the state of our political system and what has happened to the people's ability to govern, you know, to find basis for pragmatic compromise. And I think that great strength of our country, that in the crisis, we were able to craft a relatively nonpartisan strategy to try to protect the country from much worse damage. But even at that time, you know, we'd seen a substantial erosion, frankly, in the ability of the political system, to deal with tough long-term challenges. And of course, that's eroded dramatically further, I think, since. And I think the economic challenges we face as a country, however daunting they are, I don't think are fundamentally about an absence of ideas or solutions that we think have some chance of being better than what we live with. Our challenge is getting those through a deeply damaged, dysfunctional political system.
So not to – go ahead, Hank.
Yeah,
and then I want to round it out.
It's a political challenge because the country is polarized. People get their facts from different places. The country is divided. So a economic issue is by definition a political issue. And the only solutions are going to be bipartisan. I mean, none of us have any patience with people that come up there and say it's only my way or the highway.
Well, so
Ben and I, one of the things I remember is two of us being up there dealing with some right-wing House Republicans where we were having a hard time with TARP. And remember, we won't name the congresswoman, but we were talking, we thought we were answering all the questions. And afterwards, she came up to us, right, Ben? And you remember? And she basically said, well, you've convinced us, but convinced me, but what am I ever going to say to my constituents? Because they believe in free markets. So, you've convinced me, I can't do anything about it, and I'll pray for you. I mean, that was
thoughts and prayers.
Yeah. Do you remember that?
Yeah. I also remember somebody in that same meeting, a Republican congressman, saying, you know, well, I hear all what you're saying, but so far in our local community back in wherever, he said, we're not seeing any problems yet. And I said to him, you will.
Yeah, I
and
remember.
They did.
Yeah.
Okay, so look, so here's the deal. Not to end it on a down note, but the through line of a lot of this conversation and a lot of what you three have said in the last 10 years is that you were able to work together and have people believe you when you said it was dire. The problem is that we have to believe the people now. And do you think we are equipped to deal in the present environment with a crisis like this or any crisis? Because there's another one coming. All three of you know there's another financial crisis coming.
I'm going to try to take it to a higher level and say something. I spend a lot of time outside of this country. I spend a lot of time in China. I spend time overseas. And despite our economic issues, we still are not only the biggest, but the most diverse, the strongest economy in the world. And our young people are amazing in terms of their innovation, in terms of their creativity. And so the way I look at it is there's a big if, but we have to fix our messes. And if we can fix our messes, and we got plenty of time, we got time to do it before we lose our economic competitiveness, I think that the young people in this country are going to be able to accomplish amazing things. But we can't do that unless we have strong political leadership emerge. That's paramount.
What do you want people to take away from this conversation? Which is another way of asking, why did you three decide to do this? Tim?
I think what we're trying to do is to help people step into our shoes at that moment and get a better appreciation for what it takes to protect people from these things. Why is that important? It's important, again, because we're unlikely to have seen the last financial crisis. These things, these systems are very fragile. Whatever you do, they tend to break. And it's important for people to understand that you don't want the defenses we built to erode, allow them to erode over time. And it'd be better to go into the next thing with not just more degrees of freedom, but with some learning from the lessons we earned so that our successors can make better choices in the moment. You know, again, this is not the most important thing facing the country right now. The reforms we put in place are hugely important in making the system more stable, more resilient. But you should take advantage of a moment when, in many ways, many other aspects of the economy are doing relatively well, to make sure you think about the, you know, the crisis next time.
I think we all believe that it's important that the American people understand what it is we've gone through, so we minimize our chance of going through something like that again. Now, you're right. Crises are inevitable. No one's going to outlaw economic gravity. As long as you've got major economies, you're going to have excesses. They're going to manifest themselves in the financial system, and you're going to have a crisis. Bankers will get usually all of the blame, and they deserve a lot of the blame, but the root cause are flawed government policies. So I think what's important for us is to have people not forget that, to recognize that although we can't prevent financial crises, we can expect to limit their damage by getting to the excesses before they're too great, and then having the tools to put out the fire sooner and meeting them with real force. We're certainly not here taking victory laps. None of us feel that. But we really think this is going to be a huge mistake if people don't take the right lessons from this and do everything we can to minimize going through something as horrific as we went through.
Ben, last word to you.
Well, you asked if the system is safer. I think it is safer. I think the reforms were, on the whole, quite constructive. The banking system is stronger. Oversight is better. The tools are mostly better, although some of the tools we used during the crisis were taken away. Mm-hmm. So it's not an unambiguous improvement. But overall, I think the system is stronger. But the enemy is forgetting that as time passes and the memory of this gets further in the rearview mirror, you know, then you'll start hearing from Congress and from the banks, you know, well, this is going to constrain lending. We should really start undoing all of these things as soon as possible.
Which we're hearing today.
A little bit. So far, not too bad. But I think it is important we remember that financial crises do happen. I'm not that fatalistic. I don't think big ones necessarily have to happen all that often. But when they do happen, you want to be prepared. You want to have the tools, and you want to have a system which is strong enough to withstand the kinds of shocks which normally occur.
And we all, although we all agree the system is safer and we're much better off in that regard, I think all of us also believe we'd be better off if we had some stronger tools. Okay, they've taken away the ability to guarantee liabilities that we use for money market funds. They've taken away some of the Fed's emergency lending on a one-off basis. Although I totally agree with what Ben says about the system being net safer, I, for one, am not relaxed about the fact that whoever succeeds us, if and when there is another epic crisis, I believe they're going to have to go back to Congress and get tools that they don't have to be able to meet this with the kind of force it takes to limit the damage.
I'm going to let you guys get on the road. Thanks for taking the time.
Thank you.
Yeah, good.
So that's it for Hank, Ben, and Tim. They said I could call them that, by the way. It's been part of our year-long project on the financial crisis and the 10 years since. We call it Divided Decade. You can find all of that project, as well as the transcript of this interview, at marketplace.org. And if listening is your thing, we put the whole hour plus that the four of us talked into a special episode of the Marketplace podcast. Subscribe, and it'll just show up for you.
Coming up.
I would have to go ask the other women in the office, am I corporeal? Can you see and hear me?
The answer from Hollywood is probably no. But first, let's do the numbers. Well, you knew it was going to be the Wawas, right? I mean, even I knew that. And I don't get to pick the music. The Dow Industrial's off 724 points today, 2.9%, 23,957. The NASDAQ off 178 points, 2.4%, 7166 is the number there at the bell. The S&P 500 down 68, that is 2.5%, 26.43. Industrial companies with heavy international exposure fell because tariffs. Caterpillar dug down 5.7% today. Deere & Company drilled down 4%. Plane maker Boeing off 5.1%. Spirit AeroSystems, which is Boeing's largest parts supplier, off 3.3% today. Falling bond yields depressed bank shares. Citigroup, B of A, and Wells Fargo all gave up 4.1%. You're listening to Marketplace.
You go first this time.
Hey, I'm Molly Wood.
And I'm Kai Rizdahl.
Our podcast, Make Me Smart, is back, and we are exploring something you need to succeed in business, politics, you know, basically everywhere.
It is the art, the lost art, some might say, of compromise.
Yeah, because this country is not going to get where it needs to go. Frankly, you and your boss are not going to get where you need to go if you cannot even get people in the room.
We're not doing the room.
The
where
room
it
where not, it happens.
We're not.
How come we can't? Can we just compromise on this one issue?
No.
Just sing like a little bit?
No. Check us out at makemesmart.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Last Friday afternoon, before most people had ever heard of Cambridge Analytica and what it had been doing with all of that Facebook data that it has, an associate professor of media design at the Parsons School of Design in New York City filed a legal challenge against Cambridge over in the UK, trying to force the company to send him all the data it has on him. We got that. Professor David Carroll is his name on the phone to talk about it. David, it's good to have you on.
Great to be here. Thanks, Kai.
Do me a favor and walk me through why you're the guy filing the complaint against Cambridge Analytica.
I think I was the first American citizen to request my data back in January of 2017. And when I finally got it in March, it was a bit of a revelation and started me on this journey that got me to where I am now, where we have filed a claim in British court against the company.
Well, the British court part is important. Help us understand why it's there and not here.
When I requested the data, it came from the UK and therefore is subject to UK law. And luckily for Americans, UK law is so much stronger than our laws here. And so we actually get rights in our former colonizer. How weird is that?
What did you find out about yourself when you got this? Was it like a data file or something? What was it?
Yeah, I got a letter from the company and then an Excel spreadsheet. And it had my voter registration. It had some historical results of my district. And then it had this model, which was an attempt to predict my political beliefs and my likelihood to participate and what my the sort of deviation from what I was registered as to what I actually believed.
Hmm. How did it do guessing your political affiliation and all the rest of it?
It did a good job with guessing my affiliation. It called me a very unlikely Republican. I have to admit that's true. And it ranked 10 issues, ranking them 1 to 10, and that was very peculiar. It was hard to understand what it meant, if it was accurate, and how they got it.
Hmm. What kinds of things? I mean, give me some sort of keyword phrases and identifiers.
Sure. Things like the economy, education, healthcare, gun rights.
Cambridge Analytica says it's got 5,000 data points on many, many millions of people out there. How many data points were in your profile that you got?
I mean, a little more than a dozen.
Huh.
So not even close to the 5,000 that Alexander Nix claims to have on every voter.
One does wonder what you're not seeing then.
Indeed it does. And that's what our claim is about, actually. It's okay, this is some data, but we know there's more, so we're asking for all of it.
You're a media design guy. at Parsons in New York. Why has this become an issue for you? What do you believe is at stake?
Well, I've been in the industry related to advertising and marketing and ad tech. I know how the default settings give away all of our data. So in 2015, I was kind of blowing the whistle in a way. I was like, this is going to blow up in our faces. There is harm that's going to happen. And the big thing that advertisers say is, what's the harm? There's no harm in targeting people for ads. Now we know there really is huge harm in not having any protections, not having any rights.
What do you think the harm is? Because there are no small number of people out there who say, you know what, I actually want targeted advertising. I don't want to get an ad for a rental car. I want an ad for a Kit Kat or whatever.
Sure. But the same technology is used for politics. And so the privacy of the voting booth is under assault. So when people say, I have nothing to hide, well, dig into this Cambridge Analytica SEL story. And do you still think that's true?
David Carroll. He's an associate professor of media design at the New School's Parsons School of Design. Mr. Carroll, thanks a lot for your time, sir. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on.
All right, total change of direction now from the behind-the-scenes world of the digital data world to behind-the-scenes in television. Women were, in the aggregate, just 28% of all the program creators, directors, writers, producers, executive producers, editors, and directors of photography in TV last year. That is from the latest Women in Hollywood study. Nell Scovell's long list of behind-the-scenes credits includes The Simpsons, Sabrina the Teenage Witch, Newhart as well, also with Facebook COO Sheryl Sandberg, co-authoring Lean In. Her new book about breaking into the Hollywood Men's Club is called Just the Funny Parts. Nell, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
As I was reading this book, started to count the number of times you talked about being the only woman in a writer's room, but honestly, I lost count. It's kind of staggering.
Yeah, I was... not only just the only woman in the room, but often ignored to the point where I would have to go ask the other women in the office, am I corporeal? Can you see and hear me?
Do you think, though, that we have arrived now, Hollywood specific, right, since that's your, I guess, base of operations, have we arrived at a moment where the entertainment and pop culture industry in this country is not just aware of the problem, but actually has an active desire to fix it?
Well, Frances McDormand nailed it at the Oscars saying two words, inclusion rider. And what's so wonderful about the inclusion rider is it goes beyond lip service. You know, a lot of people claim it's a pipeline problem. I don't see it that way. I call it a broken doorbell problem because they're just so – the talent is out there.
Yeah, and the women are leaning on the doorbell, right? But nobody's answering the door.
Yeah, and people of color too.
Early on in this book, you write about – somebody saying to you, you write like a guy, and it being a compliment.
It wasn't somebody. It was Gary Shandling.
Okay, not just somebody. I forgot in the moment. I forgot.
Like maybe the best stand-up?
So, all right, so look, is that a compliment from him or what?
Oh, it was absolutely a compliment from him. This is back in the 80s, and I think there was a feeling that men wrote hard jokes and women were softer. I mean, we knew Lucille Ball was funny and we knew Carol Burnett was funny, but it was a more gentle, character-driven kind of comedy. So, you know, I wrote jokes like, you know, Gary's mom walks in and says, do you need an extra pair of hands? And he says, that would double my sex life.
Hey now, public radio, come on.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Tell me how it came to be that you wound up working with Sheryl Sandberg on Lean In.
People always ask how Sheryl and I met. I lived in L.A. She lived up north. And then they kick themselves when they hear the answer because we met on Facebook.
Oh, you're kidding me.
Well, kind of. She'd been asked to give a speech but needed some help just smoothing it out. She sent the notes down to me. And in the book, I actually include the part of the notes that says, women need to lean in. And it was the first time she used that phrase.
It's all right. So I'll be honest with you. You ready? Complete honesty?
Yes.
I had no idea who you were until this book crossed my desk, right? And that's the setup for this question. You have spent a career, a long-ish career in Hollywood and in the creative writing arts, being behind the scenes. Why now have you decided to become visible about this, externally, outside the industry, I guess?
Right. So I've been making pop culture for 30 years, and I thought it would be great to pull back the curtain. And along the way, I did want to talk about the experience of being the only woman in the room, not just to inspire young women, but also to give men a perspective of the pressures and obstacles women face. If I were to write a sequel to Lean In for men, I would call it Make Room. We need our place at the table, but it would be so much easier if men would make room.
Nell Scovell. The book is called Just the Funny Parts and a Few Hard Truths About Sneaking into the Hollywood Boys Club. Nell, thanks a lot.
Oh, thank you. You know, I almost called it Just the Angry and Bitter Parts, but that would have been an 8-volume set.
Yeah, and it would not have sold as well, right? It's just tough to get
that
out.
Oh, I think it would have sold better, actually.
Yeah. Nell, thanks a bunch.
Thank you.
This final note on the way out today with a nod to the March for Our Lives coming up this weekend. Citigroup today announced what it is calling a commercial firearms policy. While saying it respects the Second Amendment, from now on, Citi's new retail clients and partners are going to have to, number one, not sell firearms to somebody who hasn't passed a background check. Number two, restrict the sale of firearms for individuals under 21. And number three, not sell bump stocks or high-capacity magazines. Citi did say specifically, though, it is not going to limit consumers' ability to use their Citi cards at merchants of their choice. We've got a link to the whole statement at marketplace.org. All right, we got to go. Rough day in the markets. As you know, Dow Industrial's off 724. That is 2.9%. NASDAQ off 178 points, 2.4%. S&P 500 down 68, 2.5%. John Buckley, Eve Epstein, John Gordon, Danielle Irby, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is Deirdre Debke. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.